Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Josh Brown, there's one major game from this year that I've not even remotely touched, and I believe that you've been getting stuck into it.
Well, Scott Telford, yes, I have. Over the weekend, I have been playing Dying Light 2 because, as you may know, it was the Jubilee long weekend last week, so we were off from Thursday until Sunday, and this started great for me. I had two great days, one of them at Slam Dunk in Leeds.
Yes.
However, I then got a cold, so all I could do was sit in my house Saturday, Sunday, and I was off work yesterday, I played the hell out of Dying Light 2.
That was a game that I thought, obviously, it had been delayed for ages. The development was all over the place, and I was going to pick it up, but I kind of just stayed away. It felt like the way that it was coming together was a bit spotty.
Yes.
And then they had that whole thing about the runtime being ridiculous, like hundreds of hours long, and it just felt like one of those games where there's going to be tons of side missions, tons of random open world stuff to do. Is it a zombified version of Ghostwire Tokyo, for example?
It is an extremely strange game. First off, I will say that this is the wind-up. We do this every single Monday. I'm Josh, joined today by Scott Telford.
Hello.
It's weird me doing the hosting right now.
One of us should impromptu. Do the actual intro to the show. Yes, wind up stuff. We always talk about the latest news talking points and whatever the latest games are. And we've actually been playing stuff.
We certainly
so
have.
We'll do that, and then we'll get to some sort of state of play type stuff. And even the Steam Deck as well.
Absolutely. So yeah, going back to Dying Light, it's obviously, like you said, you know, this was incredibly delayed for a long time. It's 7 years or so after the original came out. And it very much feels like a game from 2015, 2014. Right. You have, you know, the same kind of open world mechanics. You were taking out enemy outposts. You were liberating their version of Ubisoft Towers, which are windmills that open the map up for you and all of that stuff. You even have, and this was such a flashback for me, you have the exact lock picking mechanic that was in Skyrim.
No way. That was
in Fallout 3. I have not done that minigame in about 7 years, man. So to do it again,
it was in Fallout 4.
Made me think, how archaic is this title? And that's kind of how I would describe it. It's not a bad game by any means. Mm. You know, I've been enjoying it, but it is bloated and it feels like a game that is long overdue. I think if it came out, you know, 3 years after the original dropped, I would be looking at it more fondly and thinking about it more fondly, but because it's been 7 years, an entire console generation has passed since then, I am looking at it and it feels like a creaky window
to the past.
Yeah, a window to the past in both good and bad ways.
So the whole thing with Dying Light is the parkour stuff, and that was the thing that made me, because I played Dying Light 1 and I didn't do that much of it. I never like first person platforming. I never feel like I can really get a feel for where I'm going to land, and I don't like the momentum of it that much. I just didn't really vibe with Dying Light. I know it's a massive fan favorite and people love the parkour mechanics, and that game is held up as the only game that ever did first-person parkour, like, well. Obviously, there's Mirror's Edge or whatever. But what have they done to differentiate or maintain the Dying Lightness of the game? Or does it feel like Skyrim with zombies?
Funnily enough, you mentioned Skyrim with zombies there. It actually,
I think they did at one point in development. They said they were
really
aiming to do more, like, it was something when they were talking about the runtime, and they were like, oh, we want to make, like, a Skyrim-sized world or something like that.
Yes.
And that was when they were like, it'll take you 800 hours to do everything, and it's like, yeah, no one's ever going
to
do that.
Well, that's something I need to get onto, because they have taken inspiration from Bethesda RPGs, and they have tried to essentially make Dying Light an RPG with this game. But briefly going back to the parkour system, essentially what they have done to improve the mechanics of everything that was in Dying Light 1 is just make them bigger, add to them. Like, the world itself is bigger, but it is kind of more fluid in the way that you are parkouring around. Like, it feels fun. It feels like you have a real sense of momentum, and it's just just a great way to traverse an open world like this. Mm-hmm. You know, it made me nostalgic for like the older Assassin's Creeds, where you would do, obviously, you know, a lot of climbing, a lot of exploring, and that was kind of the main focus. Here, I've barely done any zombie killing. It's mostly just been running around and traversing and what have you, and they've incorporated new mechanics into this game. Obviously, the kind of, it's not a wingsuit, it's like more like a glider, I suppose, like in Breath of the Wild, that you can use to traverse the more vertical city this time around, and you can, you know, fly over these kind of gusts of wind that carry you higher and replenish your stealth.
Like Anthem. Stealth.
Yeah, like Anthem, replenish your stamina and what have you. So it's essentially they've taken what you... everyone liked about Dying Light and made it bigger. That doesn't always work, because what I actually really liked about the original Dying Light was its tightness and its compactness. The world was big, but it was more dense.
Yeah.
So it felt like you actually had a real sense of progression as you were progressing through it. You know, you got to know it more. You got to go inside the interiors of buildings more. Admittedly, you do spend more time in Dying Light 2 kind of just running past things, which I think is a missed opportunity in a way. It feels more like a sandbox than a city, which the first one very much felt like a city.
That's a very, very, very key distinction, because if there's one thing that I've gravitated more towards over time, it is tight focus. Like you said, density is a key thing that I look for in my open world games, which I'm going to talk about Sniper Elite when we get there, but like that's one of the things that made me go like, this is the future of open world games, is sort of Hitman sized, medium to large size levels, but they feel curated and they feel like filled with specific AI scripts and not just here's a bunch of stuff. A direct comparison would be the Sonic Frontiers stuff. I don't know if you've been keeping up with...
I have not.
The Sonic Frontiers, because it's Sonic's first open world game. And it looks horrendous. It just looks like a tech demo. And I love Sonic, but it just looks like an Unreal tech demo. And the reaction to that has just been, have you made a game? Or have you just put Sonic in an open world?
Right.
Because it's just open and barren, and there's just stuff to do in a bunch of different directions. But it feels really stodgy, and it's just, it doesn't feel compelling. And I feel like one of the ways that, you know, there was the whole open world boom of the 2000s, and that sort of challenge to make the biggest game possible. And then we've kind of done that, and we've gone, okay, what does it feel like to have a game that'll take you hundreds of hours to traverse? And then now we've kind of gone, okay, let's bring it back in, let's refine it, and let's do like you know, let's up the density and everything. So I guess that's another reason why Dying Light feels kind of old, because I remember when you went through Days Gone, that was kind of endemic of that old school stuff of big old world stuff to do, but you don't really need to do any of it.
This is very similar to Days Gone, and it's not just because they both obviously are centered around zombies and kind of like these post-apocalyptic games, just in terms of how they approach their open world, and more importantly the content in that open world. Like, there are things to genuinely find fun to find in Dying Light 2, but they are few and far between. There's a lot of repeated kind of encounters, a lot of repeated activities, all of that stuff. You can tell how they've bulked it out, because the main campaign itself isn't really that long. There are a lot of side quests, and that's where the game does excel. But the thing is, when it comes to like the main quest specifically, they have taken inspiration from the Bethesda by making it the worst part of the game. It's the most forgettable kind of like story. And going back to what I said earlier, they've tried to make it an RPG. So the whole gimmick this time around is that you're essentially doing missions for a bunch of different factions, and then you get to decide who you want to side with. You know, make decisions.
The Imperials or the Stormcloaks.
Yeah, that have ramifications on how that plot develops. And some of the scenarios are actually really interesting and really engaging and surprising. There are a few twists along the way that are really cool to see. The issue is that the writing itself is not good. The writing of the characters is, again, very much in the vein of a 2015 game. You know, you've got your kind of like cringy macho like characters in there, and the voice acting isn't incredible. So they've done it. They've risked it all essentially by taking what you enjoyed about Dying Light and this time doubling down on the thing that people didn't enjoy, which was the story.
The villain as well from Dying Light 1.
The villain, absolutely, which is commendable because, you look at the criticism, you say, I want to address that, but sadly for me, how they have addressed that and by doubling down on the writing when the writing isn't so good does kind of bring the experience down for me. If you ignore that, you can have like a really good time. It's just a shame that while the scenarios of the plot are quite engaging, the actual moment-to-moment storytelling isn't compelling and actually is confusing at times.
I feel like there's an old video that... movie review critic Chris Stuckman did. I think it was called like the epidemic of forgettable movies or something like that. It was a few years ago.
Yeah,
it crosses over into games because you get stuff like this, kind of like Ghostwire Tokyo, like kind of like Dying Light 2, where it is just, you know, the production values are high enough. It looks engaging. It's like, this is, I remember thinking this with The Division. It's like, and it's not that I quite like The Division 1, but only for 20, 30 hours-ish. Like, it was one of those games, which is always the case, where it's the same after 30 hours as after 30 minutes. And I get that assumption from Dying Light. I don't know if that's true or not, but like, it's that feeling and it's that thing of so many, you know exactly what this was going to be. And it's like, you can go and get a game and it'll give you 50 to 100 hours of something, yeah. But whether it's engaging or memorable, like, you know, it's just something. It's go have a video game for 50 hours. Like, and I always want something more than that. And it's like, sometimes absolute fast food, I'll need to binge a podcast or something, I can put something like this on. But it's like mastication, the genre, yeah. Like the term for when cows chew grass for like 10 hours or whatever it is. It's like that. It's just something to do for like a few hours.
Absolutely. That's very much Dying Light 2 in quite a generous way. Mm. You know, I'd give it something like a 7 out of 10 or right. What have you. It very much is a podcast game. I've literally been listening to so many podcasts while playing through...
Batman Unburied?
Not quite yet, but while playing this game. And that's like fine, you know what I mean? But I've just decided now, I think, that when it comes to open world games specifically, I need it to have some kind of like central thesis or some kind of thing that all the mechanics orbit around, yep. Because otherwise you get something like Dying Light, which, you know, you look at it and there are things to engage with in there that are fun. There are some good systems, but they're all kind of like isolated and nebulous. And it's like, yeah, I could do a fun side mission, but how does that connect to the rewards of, you know, this random activity or this story mission? You know what I mean? They almost feel, and because they probably were, developed by like completely different people and then constructed at the last minute. And like I said, that can make for some cool times and there's a good few hours, but it also makes for hours that are forgettable.
Ultimately, would you recommend it? Because this is one of the only games of this year so far that I've not touched yet. And it's one of the, like, it's one of the biggest, if it is, the thing is, it's so weird. Its reception was so muted. Like, yeah. It was after so many years of it coming out. And I thought they actually turned the optics of the game around pretty strongly when they started doing the dev diary stuff. Because they had that whole green screen studio. They made it look like they were sitting in the game world when they were interviewing all the different staff members and stuff. And the different creative leads and everything. And considering the development hell of it, I was like, oh, it's cool you guys turned this around. But I've only seen mixed to negative reactions to Dying Light 2 over time. Like, I checked out the Reddit the other day because I was like, I'll just see what the general fandom is saying. And they were all sort of like, this game gets worse the more you play it, or this isn't like, doesn't, you know, doesn't have the same sort of punch as Dying Light 1 or the following DLC or whatever. And it's that kind of thing where I feel like Dying Light 2 finally sort of shambled out, pardon the pun. But it is that thing where it's just kind of there if you want it. There's no real reason to pick it up unless you just want to thwack some zombies with a pipe.
That's absolutely it. If you do want to thwack some zombies with a pipe and you want to run around.
Only if it means something, Josh.
Really, you know, beautifully rendered open world. Like, I would recommend it if you're just after something to kind of plug a gap. Mm. If you're after a podcast game, if you're after just a decent set of mechanics for 10, 20 hours, then yeah, pick it up. I'll say two things, actually. One, it has an absolutely abysmal introduction that sets it up terribly, and you need to push through that and then realize, there actually is something good here and worthwhile. And two, it makes the same mistake that Aliens Colonial Marines did.
Oh, no.
In that it
doesn't
forefront the actual enemies and monsters that you're there for, the zombies, and instead, at least in the main campaign, for the majority of main missions, you're actually fighting just dudes, and it's like...
Why?
Why are there so many missions where I'm just fighting, like, guys, or, like, bosses, where it's just the same three dudes with, like, machetes or clubs, and it's like, you got this... cool, excellent zombie system. You've got this excellent gore system. Mm-hmm. And yet in the main story, at least, it's like you don't even want it to be a Dying Light game.
I absolutely think that's because they're chasing the Far Cry crowd. And that, I also think, because of how much it's been pushed back, that this was meant to release in the Far Cry, the boom of Far Cry before Far Cry 6, like before everybody kind of got sick of that franchise. Because there's so many things that you're mentioning, like the glider or the way that they, like that the fact that they've sort of diluted the parkour-ness of it to sort of give you more open world stuff to do, and another generic villain, another generic writing. It's like, that's Far Cry, like to some degree.
100%. The thing, the game that it has reminded me of the most, apart from the first Dying Light, going through it, is Far Cry 6. 6. I think it's better than Far Cry 6, but everything that you just said there is spot on, and you've not even played it. You know what I mean? It's like,
because I feel like I know what it's going to be. Like,
absolutely.
That's one of the biggest problems with it. I'm so curious. I'm kind of hoping it comes on Game Pass before the end of the year, because I just want to get more hands on with it, because it's the only thing I've not played this year that feels like it has a reputation around it, or feels like it has a sort of energy around it where you should give it some time. But I guess we'll see what you think when you've finished it. But you said you were like zeroing in on the end of it.
Really close, like 2/3 of the way through, I would say. So yeah, definitely enough to get like a good overview of it. I've seen like the big maps, you know what I mean? I feel like I almost feel like I've already got my fill of it.
Well, that's the thing. That was my thing with Ghostwire Tokyo, where I keep hovering over that on my PS5 dashboard going like, I really should finish this, but I have zero pull to do so. And it's because it's one of those games. Like I said, we don't really have a name for that genre where it's just a bunch of stuff in an open space kind of game where the vast majority of what you're doing doesn't matter. It's just numbers to go up. Like, yeah. I just don't care. Even though that's not to say that Ghostwire Tokyo's pull is not brilliant. And I'd recommend the prequel comic. Like, there's all that stuff. But yeah, there's something about that stodgy kind of feeling where it's like, I'm just killing time. That on the other side of a pandemic, I want to do something more purposeful.
I think we should do a podcast at some point on just like the stodge of certain AAA games, because I remember playing Horizon Forbidden West, which I really loved, but that felt like so overstuffed that going to something like Sifu, which was so clean, both in its visual presentation and mechanical feature set, that I just gravitated towards that because it did have this kind of like straightforward, just kind of like cleanness to it. And it's almost the same reason I'm also gravitating towards playing Ninja Gaiden on the Game Pass, because that trilogy is just launched on there, because I'm like, I want the... Simplicity is maybe reductive, but I want the simplicity. I want the cleanness of that set of mechanics, that visual style, over something as visually muddy and kind of mechanically overwhelming as a Dying Light 2.
Yeah, I think it's like wanting, like, to know that you're not, one, to know you're actually going to be able to finish it. It's not going to take 100-odd hours across weeks for you to get through something. And then two, for something that was made with a certain, like, purpose in terms of the storytelling or, like, the pacing or whatever. Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that as this weird quasi-genre has taken off, it's only pushed me back towards stuff that feel focused and refined. Sifu is like this awesome, like, flex punch of a game. Like, I love that thing so much. You might say it's the third best game of the year, Joshua.
Some would say.
But those people will be outed in the next month or so when certain videos go online, but we'll find out. But yeah, I'm going to pivot into Sniper Elite 5, which I'll do quite quickly because I've just done a massive 180 on that game. I feel like, because we talked about it, I think, last week or the week before, just saying that it just felt a bit awkward, sort of weird to get used to. The aim sensitivity was super high. The opening of the game takes, I don't know, 20 minutes-ish to kind of get going. It takes a beat to get used to the amount of options that you have open to you. And it's not as streamlined and as punchy as Sniper Elite 4. However, I only think that works in its favor the more that I played it. I was always going to play more of it anyway, even though I felt that it was quite off-putting at the very beginning. And it's just turned into one of the best games of this year. If not, one of the best examples of how to do a new age stealth game. Like, literally, this is how the future of the stealth genre can be. Like, you have these massive Hitman-sized worlds that are, you know, like, have a million different ways that you can infiltrate, different ways that you can take out targets. You can also hang way back, and because, obviously, we're on newer hardware, the draw distance is massive, is the biggest it's ever been, and you can see across the entire map, and then you can work out the bullet drop and the wind resistance and whatever, and the game can help you with those things, too, if you don't want to have it on the hardest difficulty, and then just pull off, these incredibly satisfying headshots, gut shots, testicle shots, if you want, or whatever, and that goes alongside all the Splinter Cell style takedown animations that you have, whether you're hanging off a ledge or dropping down onto a guy or taking someone out from around a corner. It's stealth gaming, the stealth genre, like, perfected. Like, it's just, you have a listen mode if you want to know where everybody is around you. You can kind of pick up on the minimap where clusters of enemies might be, so you can kind of tweak all those things so you don't know exactly where someone is, but they're in that, you know, area, and then tag them manually yourself. And it just has this really great loop of taking a bunch of dudes out, looting their bodies or whatever, finding better equipment. And then you also, the way that the levels play out, you know, you'll find intel that'll tell you this other most wanted target is somewhere off on the other side of the map. And so, you know, you're only spending hours in each map just sort of doing every little bit thing, because every part of it is just so satisfying. And I love the way, one last thing is, I love the way they handle AI, like pockets of AI.
Okay.
Like, even if you, actually, I got two last things. One thing is, you know, even if you go in guns blazing, something goes wrong, you get spotted, whatever it is, you can have a shootout, you can just disappear. There's a whole, you know, the last place you were seen, Splinter Cell Conviction style thing, where you can lose the enemy, like the AI will pursue you. But if you then just go, you know, down, because the worlds are, the maps are so big, when you get to the next place, they're not activated, or maybe a couple of them are, or whatever, and it lets you sort of reset that stealth. Like, I'm always resetting checkpoints to do stealth games properly,
yeah.
But the game kind of does that anyway, or its checkpointing is good if you want to do that. And the last thing is that they have Dark Souls-style or Deathloop-style infiltration, invasion methods from other players.
Right.
So I eventually turned it off because it got in the way of my stealth brain too much, but I did have some of the best sniper showdowns across these maps where the game just tells you you've been invaded by someone somewhere in the map, and obviously you're all hunkered down, like, in the middle of a bush waiting to take out someone else anyway, and then all of a sudden you're like, is that AI moving like a person would? I think that's them. And there's all these different ways that you can, if you're the invader, you can mess with the player by calling more reinforcements and stuff on them, or you can just, as the person trying to defend, try and spot that person and take them out, and looking for the rifle glint as they're aiming for you and things like that. It gets very battle royale really immediately, you know, nice. Where you're using camouflage to your advantage and everything. And so it's just such a bulky, perfected package. I think that it has, a weird intro that's quite off-putting. But it doesn't take very long. And if you just kind of go with it,
yeah,
kind of go with the amount of options on offer, I think this might be one of the best stealth games ever made. Like, I'm thinking Chaos Theory. Like, it's way up there.
I mean, you've convinced me, man. Like, I'm definitely going to be checking this thing out again. If you're comparing it to Splinter Cell, if you're giving it the thumbs up, hell yeah, I will try that thing once more.
You should. I think that, like I said, it's just worth diving into. It's on Game Pass, so that's over on Xbox if you already have Game Pass. Just give it a shot. The opening's a bit sort of stilted. I think that they sort of roll out the mechanics a bit weirdly, and it does take a bit of intuition or just going with a confidence on your part as a player to be like, I'm just going to push the buttons and see what options I have, and just start experimenting with the different gadgets. You know, you can sort of faff around with whistles and decoys and timed mines, and all the weak spots that are on different people, but they're also on vehicles, and you can put mines down on the, you know, you might want to blow up a, switch your ammo type and take out a guy silently and then blow up a mine that's taken out a vehicle. There's just loads of things like that where you can just have fun in a sandbox, but it's condensed enough, it's dense enough, and yeah. Where there's always another enemy or there's something else to interact with. And this game's third level, which is the last thing I'll say on this game, is easily one of the levels of the year. I know we're at the half mark, but it'll be amazing if something beats that.
Right.
It's like this insane sort of oceaned water marked off kingdom level thing that you just sort of, you come out from like the distance and you can just spend ages shooting dudes from a million miles away, getting all your angles right and everything, like silent scope style, or you can go in and infiltrate proper Sam Fisher Hitman style.
I was gonna say, that in itself sounds incredibly Hitman, yeah. In the way that's designed.
And it's just like, yeah, you have all those options, and if you've played stealth games for a while, you'll think in those ways of like, I'm going to deploy like a Sam Fisher mentality or Sniper Elite's own mentality or whatever. I think it's brilliant. I feel like I've talked for about 10 minutes.
You have not.
But it's really, really good. We should pivot into State of Play stuff, because Sony had their big State of Play during, I think it was during the Jubilee weekend when we were away.
It was Thursday night in Scott Ilford.
Go on.
I have a really boring story I'm going to tell you, because I've never been more happy to get back from the pub, right? Because
right.
I thought, stupidly, that it was on at 6 p.m. UK time. It was not. It was on 6 p.m. US time. So I thought I'd missed it while I was out in Leeds, got back to the hotel just in time for it. And it turned out to be like one of the best State of Plays they've ever done. And I was watching it on this like screen on crappy hotel Wi-Fi, like 260p, thinking, this is blowing me away.
The thing with State of Play is I've learned to minimize, if not eliminate, my expectations. I feel like every other one that they've done has been abysmally disappointing, and they've misread the audience or what a State of Play can even be every single time. And so for this one, the amount of different things that they went in and just went, no, we've got this, we've got this, we've got this. I think they opened on Resident Evil 4 Remake.
I was in the toilet. I missed it. I didn't notice until the end. I came in when it was Resident Evil 8 VR. I was talking to my girlfriend. She was like, oh, you've only missed Resident Evil. Afterwards, I realized it was Resident Evil 4.
What
do you mean I've only missed Resident Evil? It's the thing I was looking forward to the most.
We should talk about the slightly mixed reaction to this, because it's interesting. For me and you, or people who have followed the channel, they'll know that it leaked a while ago that the way Capcom were reapproaching this game was to change, quote unquote, quite a lot about it in terms of how much you value or identify the tone of Resident Evil, the campy sort of overall tone to it, with the appeal of Resident Evil 4. I very much do. I love the energy of that game. I love how over the top it is. I like the pivot point that Resident Evil took back in 2004. And I was on board for Resident Evil 5 and then I dropped off for RE6. And it's interesting that they've gone back since 7. And then obviously RE2 Remake or Resident Evil 2 Remake was way more serious again. So with the remake of 4, the lighting is completely different. It's way more horror focused. It's not as overblown. And they've said in, or that it sort of leaked, you know, months ago or whatever, that this was going to be almost like the Resident Evil 2 remake, but done RE4 style. I think it looks solid. I think the fact that Resident Evil 4 still plays immaculately makes this more optional and makes this sort of general palette tweak or tone tweak more optional. It lets it stand alongside the original RE4.
100%. I fully agree, and I'm excited for them to make changes because, like you mentioned there, Resident Evil 4 is still so ubiquitous. Like, you could go on your PS4, PS5, whatever console you want right now,
and
Steam Deck, and play Resident Evil 4, and it will hold up. Like, that's still almost a perfect game.
Yeah.
Like, it's still incredible. You can jump in there right now. It's incredibly accessible. So, because of that, if they're going to spend the time and millions of dollars doing some kind of remaster or remake, I would prefer them to make it different because otherwise I think, what's the point? Yeah, you can make a prettier version of the Resident Evil 4 that exists right now, but we've already got HD updates. We've already got higher resolution versions, higher frame rate versions of that game already available. So if you're going to spend the time and the resources to reapproach that title, yeah, give us something different as you did with Resident Evil 2 and 3, which were markedly different from the original games, not just in the ways that they changed, you know, the camera to be over the shoulder and what have you. Like, if you're going to go back to this title that is arguably perfect already,
pretty much,
like, give us a reimagining, give us a completely altered take on it. At least that's my opinion. That to me is way more exciting than just Resident Evil 4 as it is with more visuals, because while I would take that, you know, if these games take 3 years to make, do something a little bit different.
Yeah, I back that. Because I have one question, though. When was the last time you played the original Resident Evil 4?
It was literally only a few years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, just
so that game, I went back to it a few weeks ago. Something reminded me of Resident Evil 4. Maybe it was just a leak that we looked at or something. So I bought another copy of it because I've already got like 7. But I didn't have one on the Switch. And I was like, I want to play this on the train, goddammit. So I got that. And I was going back through it, and I haven't played through that game past the opening village bit in quite some time. Me and my wife played through it, and she was like, this is too much. We're not doing past the opening bit.
Right.
We tried every single opening for Resident Evil to see which one stuck, and we ended up doing more of 7. Anyway, with this game, though, with Resident Evil 4, I kind of forgot how Metal Gear Solid the writing of Leon is.
Yes.
Like, he's almost like the way Solid Snake is in Metal Gear Solid 1, where he's just flirting all the time, and he's like, there's a lot of sort of horn in that game.
There is.
That I think they'll get rid of in the new one because it just doesn't really fit. It's very 2004.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, male video game protagonist talking to any female, and I think they'll change some of that stuff. But yeah, I get that, like, you can kind of play it off as like campy, fun tone, but there are parts of it that I think they'll ditch for the remake.
Absolutely. And it's, I want to make like a distinction between me thinking that changing it is a good idea in practice versus what I actually think about those changes.
Right.
Because, you know, from the trailer, from the very short snippet that we've seen so far, for instance, you know, setting the opening scene at night to me is almost sacrilege.
I know what you mean.
Because, like, while the night is obviously scary, everyone is afraid of the dark, Resident Evil 4's atmosphere was so distinct from the previous games because you kind of had this entirely strange new European setting that was, you know, grey and it was overcast.
Well, it's gaming's Wicker Man.
Absolutely.
Like, that's why it was so immediately iconic. No one had ever done that before.
100%. And it's almost like, I think we might have talked about this before, you know, for me, one of the scariest scenes genuinely ever is in Shaun of the Dead. In the morning of Shaun of the Dead, when Sean goes to the shop, I was so scared of that as a kid.
Really?
Because it subverted my expectations of making the horror a part of the daytime. And that felt so subversive at the time because, you know, you expect bad things to happen at night. You don't expect to be like attacked during the day. And it's like a subtle change in like the grand scheme of things. People might just say, well, it's just like going from dusk till the night. But for me, it does kind of change the texture of the horror in a way that kind of, for me, potentially takes away from the uniqueness of the atmosphere in Resi 4 and makes it something more standard, perhaps.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
No, I totally agree. I think that it's weird, because I think that's one of the most obvious and immediate changes and one of the earliest things that leaked about the new version of it. And it's also interesting because Resident Evil Village was kind of this quasi-sequel to RE4, and that in itself is set at the daytime, or it is at the beginning anyway. Yeah. Or at least it fluctuates, I guess, but you do have big portions in the daytime. So maybe they're putting this out there as the first piece of footage to sort of shock people and go, look how much we've changed. And then we'll get to do that central area in the daytime at some point, and then we can have the whole, oh my God, it does remind me of the original type thing. But I think their overall game direction is to differentiate it. Because in one of the most recent press releases, I saw this doing the rounds on Twitter, Capcom are referring to it internally as the reawakened version of Resident Evil 4.
Right.
So it's not necessarily a remake, it's not a replacement or whatever, it's just this other version of it.
Well, I mean, one of the reports that came out back in the day that we covered on the news but may not have talked about on the podcast was suggested that the original developers for this were the developers for the Resident Evil 3 remake.
Yeah.
Obviously, that wasn't received as well as the second one was, and apparently like the takeaway that Capcom had from that was that they played it too safe, they yep. stuck too close to the template of the original, and one of the successes of Resident Evil 2 was remixing it, you know, like introducing Mr. X, who was only part of like one campaign yeah. in the original, like making him a central figure, and not only just regurgitating what was there before, but you know, remixing it. Reawakening it. And yeah, it seems like they very much kind of like decided that, swapped the developers around to the people who made the second game and were like, right, you know, carte blanche. What would you do if you were making this from the ground up in 2022?
I tell you what they'll do, and I kind of don't want them to do this, even though they'll kind of have to do this, is make the Bagman, the Chainsaw Man, the next Pursuer enemy. Because he was one of the original ones. But I am sick of Pursuer AI. I never loved it in Resident Evil 2 anyway, because I've got puzzles to solve. I've not got time, Mr. X. Leave me alone.
That's fascinating, and I agree. I think if they introduce a Pursuer enemy like that, I'll be a little bit disappointed. Because
they'll have to, because otherwise how do you do Chainsaw Man?
Well, you just have him be a mini-boss, surely, like that.
Yeah.
That's not so outdated that they can't just throw him in like that, should we?
I feel like they've played with the idea of like Pursuer AI as their thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like they were I say that, I feel like I say blow their load every week on Monday.
You do.
They blew their load, their nemesis-sized load on Mr. X, and they should have kept that AI, that surprise, that whole revelation of what it felt like to be pursued for Resident Evil 3. Nemesis. That's what that thing was.
Yes.
Like, to pursue you through the entire game. They did that with Mr. X, then it felt reused with Nemesis, and then it felt reused when it happened like four times in Resident Evil Village, especially with Lady Dimitrescu.
Yep.
So it's that thing where I'm sick of that. I get sick of there's an enemy always behind you walking towards you slowly that you can't kill.
Me too. Even though I've just talked about, you know, changes to this game, I think one of the strengths of 4 that they should keep is its pacing and its linearity in a lot of ways. Yeah, just go. You don't need to shoehorn in you know, wide linear sections when you don't need to. You don't need to shoehorn in these enemies that will pursue you. You've already got the regenerators later on anyway that kind of fit that same mold. Like, keep it snappy, keep the pacing high, and then do whatever you want to do with the story and whatever within that framework, I think.
Yeah, totally. I think it's the regenerador. Yes. I think they'll nail that thing's reveal. Because in the original game, it's just random game, like just in-game, and you hear it for ages, and eventually it comes around the corner, and you're like, what the hell is that? I kind of hope they keep that, but if they remix the lighting, especially, they can make that scene, like, really pop, I guess, if it's something... Because the fandom has only enhanced that thing over time.
Definitely.
As one of the scariest enemies in gaming history, and etc. But yeah, Resident Evil 4, the remake opened the show. I'm just going to jump around stuff, because I forget what order it was in. But the next big talking point, I think, is the fact that Stray, the next PlayStation exclusive, is coming to the PlayStation Plus Premium service, which is their way, Sony's way, of kind of driving a wedge in between their own £70 premium price point stuff, saying we're never going to do first party releases, or at least exclusives day one, and full on Game Pass releases where everything is expected day one, where they can pick and choose, they're going to curate it. It's interesting with Stray, because I feel like that game's reputation or general buzz is mixed anyway. I don't feel like it's fever pitch. I feel like people just go, cool, the cat game. I can get the cat game for free, or I can get the cat game as part of my monthly subscription. And that's sweet. But I feel like that's not a great way to test that whole service. I feel like the whole rollout of this premium service is kind of abysmal anyway. Like, it's out in North America in like 2 weeks or a week, and then we have it in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and you'd barely even know. Like, it's kind of crazy.
It's a strange rollout. Can I just say, by the way, that I was surprised at how many of our predictions actually came true.
I know!
Considering how mad we went, and although we didn't get straight coming to PS Plus, we did predict that a game would come to PS Plus day one. I thought it was going to be Forspoken, but it turned out to be Stray. For me, honestly, you've just mentioned people there who, you know, might just be interested in the cat game, who want to pick it up. That was me.
Yeah.
You've talked to me about Stray so many times before, and I've kind of been like, I'll wait till the reviews, I might try it.
Now, this week's Cyberpunk game, Josh.
Now, after seeing the new trailer and knowing that I'll get it for free, I will absolutely give this a go. So for me, it's worked on that level. Yes, I do think they need to push this PlayStation Plus thing way harder, but at the same time, I do think this is a win in it is a reason to invest in that service if they are going to have releases like this be there day one, that they will pick and choose, like you just said.
I do like it as a way to sort of, you know, make sure that certain games get eyeballs on them regardless. Like, I'll always point to Concrete Genie. That was a PlayStation exclusive that just absolutely bombed, that they didn't get behind it at all. And it's just you barely even knew it happened. Like, it was like sort of, I think it was 2018-ish, had really cool mechanics. It was all about like sort of doing paintings and summoning the demon world, or different demons and suppressing them and using different pieces of graffiti and wall art and everything else. And that game was just completely flat. Whereas if you put that on a PlayStation Premium service, at least people would check it out. It's already in front of you. You might as well. And I feel like that will happen with Stray. But I just thought the wider conversation on Sony's approach to tackling Game Pass, that's interesting. Because I feel like they've kind of front-loaded their appeal, the monthly appeal.
Would you say they've blown their load?
I might say they're building up. They wish they had a load to blow. Like, I wish they had a load to blow with this. Because I'm looking at what they're putting out, and they're like, well, we've got Wild Arms and Siphon Filter and Mr. Driller and whatever, and Tekken 2, and some of them have got trophies. Now, the idea of old-school games with modern trophy support is brilliant, but so far they've not they've not done enough of it. Like, it sort of feels like they're kind of holding back. It's still, like I said, I don't know if I said this on the podcast, but it feels like a whip round. It feels like they went to a bunch of studios with can in hand and just said, what can you throw in here? Because we need to do something next week. And so, I don't know, I still feel like there's a marked lack of confidence in this thing. And I feel like Jim Ryan's just gone, just put the cap game on. Just sort of throw that on as well. They want something first party or sort of exclusive. Chuck that on and we'll see how it does. And if it does well, we'll do more.
Yeah.
But right now, it's just very weak.
You could be right. It is just like, you know, whatever they have at hand. And I imagine Stray was at hand because it has been delayed, you know, so many times and what have you, and probably will, like you say, get more eyeballs on it. I don't think that's inherently a bad thing, but yeah, it's certainly not the confident kind
of push. It's awesome for Stray, but I just think it's just the whole service has such a lack of, it's just, they're just sort of, yeah, whatever. Or Game Pass, is it? Oh yeah, we're better than that, but yeah, fine, we'll do one. Yeah, whatever. Like, it just has this Sony hubris that they've always had, that they try to suppress, and it bubbles up when they're in the lead, and it's bubbling up now, and they just sort of go, oh, you peasants want backwards compatibility, do you? Like, oh, we'll do trophies, but only if the developers agree to it. Like, we're not going to mandate it, like Xbox are mandating stuff.
Yeah,
those things annoy me. But speaking of getting more eyeballs on stuff, the king of the year might be here.
Come on, who's
Callisto
this?
Protocol.
The king of the year.
There's something about this game that I'm just calling it. I don't know why. I just think it's so confident. It's so polished and purposeful, and it looks so good. I think it might dethrone Elden Ring.
That is a bold.
I don't even know why I really think this. Right. I just kind of have this thought that something could be Elden Ring for the rest of the year. And there's something about Callisto Protocol, the fact that it's Glenn Schofield, the fact that he's got over a decade of hating EA for ruining Dead Space. And you can find his old tweets where he's like swearing at EA and saying they ruined the franchise after he left and everything. You know, the guy that made Dead Space going on to do his Return franchise with this sort of dream studio that he put together. Initially, it was going to be set in the PUBG timeline, but they've managed to separate that because it was probably going to be a lead weight that would drag it down. And then the gameplay that they showed off just looks so immaculate. It just looks Resident Evil 2 remake style, Dead Space style, but next gen. And I just think it has so much. It could be like everything we described, like a really purposeful, focused single player title that nails its story, nails its atmosphere, and succeeds in a way. Like, if there's one area that Elden Ring doesn't succeed in, it's maintaining its pace the entire way through. Not that I don't think it's pacey, but I think that they have the duplicate elements, the repeat dungeons, the right. little things. If it starts coming down to splitting hairs, then which it will do.
It will do.
Elden Ring is so far out in the lead right now, you might as well just call it as Game of the Year, which we will probably do in like a month's time. But there's something about Callisto Protocol that I just think has all the elements right, and I hope that it nails everything.
First off, I will just swallow the opinion that Elden Ring is not pacey enough. I will save that for the inevitable Game of the Year podcast.
It's not pacey because I think one of the most remarkable things about it is that it has new things to show you for 100 hours. I love that. But it's the fact that if I have to poke holes in its armor, it is the repeat dungeons, the repeat bosses, which can lead to I'm just mopping this stuff up, style feel. That's what I'm going for.
I will swallow that and move on to the Callisto Project, which
I
fully agree with, man. Like the Callisto Project looks absolutely sick.
Yes.
I'm not going to say that it's going to be a Game of the Year contender just because I don't want to overhype it. Mm. I am so starved for like a great new survival horror game. And like you said, the pedigree that this has from the developers, from the trailers, the way it looks, the gnarly kind of graphics and atmospherics on display.
Creature design as well.
The creature design. I want this to knock my socks off. I'm absolutely looking forward to it a lot. And I just think like it's great to have this alongside Resident Evil 4, alongside the Dead Space remake. You know, like there are a lot of good third-person survival horror games to look forward to going into the end of this year next. That, as for me as a survival horror fan, a big survival horror fan, is just like I'm eating well.
No, right same. Now. I mean, like I think it's fascinating because I watched the trailer and then when they were like, it's coming, I think it's December 2nd or something. It's right at the end of the year, which it might not make. Like it would be really cool if it does. I feel like that game, obviously because of the COVID and the pandemic, time's just a weird warp from the last few years. But I feel like that game's barely been talked about and now it's coming out in December. But it is going to be interesting to watch that go up against the Dead Space remake, however that drops. Because for me, the Dead Space remake is just, I just shrug shoulders, I don't care. Like it's I can just go play Dead Space, it's great. But like Dead Space 2 is arguably better. But like that whole thing, you know, like this is going to come out. And like I said, it's going to be that original guy's idea, whatever he wants to do next that he wasn't allowed to do, he couldn't do, in the direction that Dead Space went in. I just think that'll imbue it with a certain passion and purpose and confidence that the Dead Space remake will just tick boxes, whereas this guy will make the boxes.
I hope the boxes are made for this. And I think at the very least, it's a reminder for us to not draft our Game of the Year list before December.
Have you seen
rolls
my
around. Well, I know this, I know. Sometimes we're like, right, the year's over, there's not going to be anything that beats this, these games will be cut off. This game cannot be cut off, I don't think. And I think it just comes out. Does it come out just in time for the Game Awards? Maybe. Hopefully.
It'll not meet the qualifiers because I think because it's the very beginning of December and they've already like filmed their stuff by then.
Okay.
I forget. I don't know if I'm breaking embargo by talking about the potential cut-off for that stuff.
No, I don't think so because Cyberpunk was the same situation, wasn't it? Like that missed out by releasing like just a few days afterwards. Mm. Not that it would have won in hindsight, but you know what I mean? Everyone was kind of mad for that.
Yeah, but the way that it's going to roll out, it's like that the very tail end of the year, there might be this Adonis of a game that just sort of wipes. Oh, it doesn't wipe out Elden Ring, but potentially claims it.
I'll tell you what, that was the real win for the state of play for me, was reminding me that we have 2022 games to look forward to. Yes, there were a lot of things in there that 2023, like Final Fantasy and what have you, but now we've got Stray, now we've got the Callisto Project, now we've got that rollerblading game
Roller
Dome is coming out this year. So that, on top of whatever comes out of the Summer Game Fest, on top of whatever comes out of the Xbox and Bethesda Showcase, hopefully will give the next half of the year the injection that we are so gagging for.
Yes, I mean, that was the thing, was that whole energy of writing, of quote-unquote writing off the year, but also knowing that Elden Ring is just so huge. Like, there hasn't really been a game release like this since 2017 when it was Breath of the Wild, and everyone knew when that release, I think it was in May, that just was going to be Game of the Year. And obviously 2017 still had Horizon and stuff, but like, this has that energy of like, it's going to take a lot to beat this game. And like I said, I can't specifically put my finger on it because we've only seen a few moments of gameplay, but there's just something about this game that I just think is so well made. And I just hope that it comes together. We should end on very quick thoughts on the PlayStation VR 2, because this was meant to be the focus of the showcase, but then it kind of just wasn't. Like, there was chunks of time devoted to it. I was checking my phone, to be honest.
No,
but
Scott.
I watched it. But it's another on rails first person thing,
it's
isn't it?
It's literally not. It's
Horizon on rails. Dinosaur walks over
that's
you and you.
No, no. It's not on rails.
Another character talking straight to you, is it?
I mean, listen, the Horizon game was the thing that excited me the least, but yes. It had everything else that I wanted when we did the last week, the podcast last week. We got The Walking Dead.
I freaked out you getting The Walking Dead sequel.
Chapter 2. That was awesome. That is everything that I wanted. The first Walking Dead Saints and Sinners game gave me some of my favorite gaming moments ever. So I'm just hoping that with the added tech of PSVR 2, that thing can be taken to a whole new level. I thought that looked incredible. Resident Evil 8, obviously coming to VR, was again music to my ears.
Resident Evil 4 remake as well, I
believe. Resident Evil 4 remake as well. There's some exciting things there. I will play through all of those Resident Evil games. Is it going to be a launch lineup that, you know, sells the casual gamer on the PSVR 2? Maybe not. Is it going to make me want to pre-order even more than I already do? Absolutely. Like, the things they announced for VR, even though it was only a fraction of the show, they just, like we've said, we ticked all the right boxes for me.
I'm very curious about what PSVR 2 feels like, and I mean literal brain capacity feels like. Like, does it literally transport you to a place? Because I didn't feel like PSVR 1 really did. Like, certain parts did. And I'll always remember, I made a life memory when I got stabbed in VR playing that Getaway type thing, the PSVR Worlds demo thing. And there's a bit where some character betrays someone and stabs you in the stomach. And my brain made my stomach hurt. And I went, that's fascinating that I can feel that. But it wasn't until I played Resident Evil 4, the original, but like done VR style on the Oculus Quest, where that thing's, the technology is just so much more responsive. Like, it's not relying on lights to track where you are or whatever. And that's when my brain went, you are here. You are doing this. You are feeling all the motion, the momentum of just walking in this space, that I was like, oh, okay, this is VR. Like, for me, it needed that extra step. So I'm hoping that that's like what the PSVR 2 is going to be. Because, like, speaking of before, you know, Jim Ryan throwing things in a bucket and hoping for the best, that was the original PlayStation VR, like reusing the PlayStation Move controllers. Yeah. And the only sync option is whether it can track headset lights. Like, what the hell was that? Like, that was like sort of, I don't know, find it in a dodgy shop on a street corner hoping for the best. Like, hell together with their tape.
That was
and
absolutely
string.
Someone at Sony who desperately wanted to do VR, and then people at the higher, at the top level being like, yeah, you can do it if you deliver it for a tenner.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Literally. It's like the Homer Simpson car of VR headsets.
Yes, it is.
Which it did its job, and I loved Super Hot on there, but yeah, it's got a lot more ground to travel. I still will have the whole conversation around, you know, can you even sell like VR? Can you even tell the average person what VR is? Because they have to try it for themselves. And then you have to do booths in physical game shops, which people don't bother with physical game shops anymore. So it's like all that stuff. But it might just be one of those things where it is just the hobbyist, like, you know, people who are into VR and you get it. Kind of similar to how I'm been into emulation on the Steam Deck. That already feels like something like that.
Is that true?
It is a bit true.
How was your Steam Deck?
It's quite nice, to be honest. It's very, very PC.
Right.
It is very much a tiny little PC. I'll not talk too much about the Steam Deck because I've only had it for a few hours. I got it yesterday, and I spent most of last night going, how do I get PsyOps the Mindgate Conspiracy onto this portable thing? And so I downloaded some games. I played a couple of things that were already pre-installed. That were already recommended. Like, there's a Valve-developed game for the Steam Deck. But it's just... it's that Valve sense of humor, which I've got to be in the mood for, where I was like, I fired up the Steam Deck, and obviously it's very PC, it's quite quirky, and it's a very bulky thing, And I was just like, there's so many little things to sort of faff with, and all these sliders and brightness and all these different things to like faff with that make it feel like when you PC, when a console person PC games,
right?
There's like a million little things to tweak.
Yeah.
And if you're into that, you love it, or it's not a big deal or whatever. It's a big deal for me. I just want to play. I hate all the faff and the setup. Like, it's like my anxiety with, like graphics options in game, performance mode, fidelity mode. Take that and times it by 20, and then that's the amount of things you can faff with. And so the very first thing the Steam Deck loaded was an error screen. So I was like, of course you did. It didn't like load wherever the Steam page was. And then I was playing the Valve-developed game, which I forget what it's called now. It's something deck builder thing. And it's like a quirky thing about working in the Portal factory and building toilets. And I was like, I want to play something that's impressive and that, like, you know, I spend all the money on this thing. So I was like, I'm going to look up all the emulation stuff. And I looked up how to get it. And I finally did get it working. I managed to drag all the files across into all the different folders and rename all the whatever it was. And I eventually played Mortal Kombat Shaolin Monks on my Steam Deck. And then Def Jam Fight for New York. And then SmackDown Here Comes the Pain and Ultimate Spider-Man. And that was when I was like, this is perfect. This is exactly what it needs to be. Because I just wanted to be an emulation station. I wanted to be the handheld version of emulation that PC players describe every single time a console person mentions something like the Nintendo Switch Online or the Game Pass or whatever. Whenever we talk about, oh my God, I wish they would put Soul Reaver on the PlayStation Premium service, and some person in the distance who's a PC person is just cackling going, I've had that for 10 years and it runs in 4K and it's 60 FPS and whatever else. So once I got that working and it just worked, all the controls just mapped and it worked, and I was playing Shaolin Monks in 60 FPS and it was beautiful, I was like, this is cool. Yeah. But there is that, it's not, the Steam Deck has not eliminated the PC faff, because as much as they try to sell the Steam machine like that, and now the Steam Deck, you've still got to be up for a lot of file drag and droppy, rename this, look at this file extension, Googling every last step of it, because there's an error message that the tutorial didn't show you and whatever.
And the thing is, I've watched you set up this podcast every week for months now. I know how much you just want things to go and how little that happens in your life.
I know. It's like, that's the thing. Consoles are the only thing that just do that for me. Everything else throws me some stupid step or some weird error message that, like, you know, I could follow like a step-by-step guide for putting my shoes on and some error message will pop up and that wasn't in the tutorial. And then I've got to go off and Google that. And then like three people experience that message and it's like, oh my God. But yeah, the point being that, yeah, the Steam Deck's very powerful. Obviously, it can run Elden Ring, God of War. Like, it has this, it is an insane piece of kit. And I think the more that I'll spend time with it, the more I'll get that. And already, I already know what I want to do. I want to get a dock for it, and I want to, like, pair it with my TV. Because there is a desktop mode, which just turns it into a PC. It just literally with a little launcher in the corner and whatever. And you can download stuff and unzip files, and it's just a PC. And I want to dock it and put it on my TV and Bluetooth a controller to it, and then finally have my Steam library on my TV as well as on the go.
I will ask the controversial question that I'm sure everyone is thinking right now, and by everyone, I mean me.
Yes.
Does this now mean that PC games are now eligible for our Game of the Year lists? Because they have not been since I have worked here.
Depends when they came out, Josh. Because it depends on the year they came out. It depends, because if something came out in early access 2 years beforehand, it's not going to be counted in the year that we're doing Game of the Year. But I guess we'll see, because we didn't count. One of the things I got a demo for was Inscription, one of the only games from last year that everyone was talking about, and it was only on Steam. And there's a demo for that on the Steam marketplace or whatever. So I got that immediately. So I'll finally be able to experience Inscription. I don't know. I feel like I just go off what most. This is an interesting conversation for maybe another time, because most outlets go off when something arrived on console. That's what they just class as that game's release day. Obviously, over time with early access and everything else, it's changed those things. But I kind of go with that's what I largely stick to.
We've certainly come down on this like for the past few years, and I would agree, just because, you know, we have less access to PC games, it makes more sense for us as a more console focused podcast, and I guess mostly,
and the audience is definitely console based.
Yeah,
as well.
Totally, to play to our strengths. It's kind of a weird question that gets brought up though.
It's the gaming version of one. You know, in film when it's
UK
release dates versus like US or worldwide release dates. Oh, what was it? Is it because we get stuff a year later sometimes, and it's like, well, that's not one of our movies of the year,
especially with the pandemic. Because obviously we're a UK based outlet, but a lot of our audience is from the US. So it's like, do we take it, Like, do we rank the 2022 movies from the UK releases, but then know that most of our audiences saw all of these movies on the 2021 list that they've been watching? It's a weird, weird thing to navigate.
We've had so many conversations, such a wider conversation. We've had so many conversations about the fact that I think now the bulk of our audience are in America. So when we're talking about currency and how much something is worth or how much something is retailing for, right, we should use dollars or we should start using more westernized stuff. That's a whole reality of living on YouTube.
I will confess something before we end this. When I was 11 years old in school, I started saying sidewalk. Now, to the Americans out there, we do not call sidewalks in the UK. We call them like a path.
Yeah.
But I thought this will be cool. And I can just say that I've said this forever. It'll be amazing. Everyone said, "You're lame," and then didn't talk to me. So that didn't work.
I said license plate for the longest time. And when I look at a license plate, I still think license plate. The UK is number plate.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
First the Gibbon and now this.
Holy hell.
Blowing the minds.
I just thought it was license plate.
No.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's a number plate in the UK, but there's all sorts of stuff. But yeah, we're not going to acquiesce to garage. But you'll do.
Well, you know,
it's a garage.
When you get, you know, your extension of your house done, you know, when you get like into aluminum, your middle age, then you might start saying garage.
I might do. If I'm feeling a bit spicy.
Acquiesce.
Yeah. I've started using acquiesce. I don't know why. I put it in an article the other day, and I've started using ensconced.
Ensconced.
If you're sort of surrounded by stuff, you're ensconced in it.
Incoherent for me is the one. Ooh. I've been trying to get into everywhere. One time in school, again, just now it's just about my life. One time in school, I knew what the word monotonous meant, right?
Right.
And when I was in year seven, I put that in every piece of English work because I knew it was
the irony
good word
of that, though.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that always got me high grades just for using monotonous. It was like a silver bullet to get, like, just cheat me way through, like, that year of school.
I, like, remember that when I was younger, just sort of words just come to your brain. You're like, well, I must have picked this up somewhere.
Yeah.
I have no idea where, but I know how to use this now. Anyway, nothing to do with video games, but, you know, the games are existing. We played some of them. We did some new stuff. And there's more games actually coming out for the rest of this year. Now,
dude,
after the State of Play. And there's Summer Games Fest and the Xbox Bethesda stuff. All sorts of things.
And The Quarry at the end of this week. That was what I rudely interrupted for.
Well, the thing is, there's more games that I've played. The Quarry at the end of this week and also Mario Strikers Battle League, which that game is a whole thing. Jules' review is going up towards the end of the week. But that game is potentially poised to be a big microtransaction mess, and I guess we'll wait and see because Nintendo's not done that on a home console release yet. The game's listed on the ESRB rating as having in-game purchases, but some of their other stuff does, but it tends to be for DLC. However, this game does have a coin system and lots of costumes and skins and stuff, and it just feels like that's what they're going to try and do with how big football and stuff is around the world. Anyway, this has been The Wind-Up. I don't know if I said that at the beginning. You did. But it's been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Thank you all very much, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.